So, could you present yourself first?
Well, my name is Togastai. I'm one of the hereditary chiefs of the Laksamisu clan of the Wet'suwet'en people in north central BC.
Can you talk about what is the situation for you and for many nations in BC who are fighting against the pipelines?
Well, the pipelines, there are quite a few pipelines attempting to force their way through our lands, and the pipelines tend to follow the Canadian regulatory system for assessing the environmental impact, and it's kind of biased. It's not kind of biased, it's very biased. The National Energy Board, for example, is the main regulatory body for industrial proposals in Canada. And the National Energy Board actually receives 100% of its revenue from the same industry that it claims to regulate. You also have the Canadian Environmental Assessment Agency, and they hire contractors to come in and do environmental assessments, which include socio-cultural impacts and socio-economic impacts from First Nations groups on proposed projects. And if anybody ever takes the time to go through all of their boring reports, you'll actually read in the conclusion of every section, it's like they rubber stamp the paragraph on, stating that there will be no impacts or there are no proposed impacts in regards to this. You know, you go through the whole report. Every report they produce says that. And it's very, very obvious that these contractors are paid to nod their heads and say yes to these programs so that they can force them through. And Aboriginal people, you know, here in BC we have unceded lands, which means we haven't signed any treaties. We've never signed any agreements. We've never lost in any war against anybody to surrender our lands to anybody. So these lands still belong to us. In 1997, here in our country, we fought in the Supreme Court of Canada for our lands, and we won our lands in principle. So we won our rights and our title to our traditional hereditary lands. And the judges that made a decision in the Supreme Court of Canada on our lands stated that it was up to the government and industries to negotiate with First Nations people in a meaningful manner. Well, they decided to skirt around the hereditary people who were in the court case in the first place and only acknowledge the people who were elected under the Indian band systems. And that creates a huge divide for the people who, like myself, who represent the hereditary system that fought for a land that has been here thousands of years. And now we have to kind of stand beside these band elected systems who've only been around for less than 80 years. And they're claiming lands that don't belong to them. You know, they're elected people who are under the federal government through the Indian Act, who have to vote in new people every 3 or 4 years and fight in their community to try and cheat their way into becoming leaders, against another system that is hereditary, that's been around for thousands of years, that's worked and isn't gone. So that's the dilemma we're in here in BC.
Can you explain your recent story, like your recent relations between like your traditional forms of governments, like you are an hereditary chief, and the band council system in BC?
We've been around for thousands of years. You know, we've got something in our culture we call it Kenga, and in our neighboring people, they refer to a Daux, and this is the origin of your people. You have a story that talks about where you come from. You have a story that talks about all of your crests and your songs, and that is your living proof as to where your origin comes from. You know, if you take on a hereditary name, you take on a name that has been around for hundreds or thousands of years, and there's a story that goes along with it that is passed down from generation to generation within the families. And those stories can only be shared in a public setting when you have to stand up and assert that you have a right to that name and a right to that territory. The band council system is completely different. Since they first forced us onto Indian reservations around 1910, our people have been forced into you know, very confined spaces, taken off of our lands, and we're told the only way that you can have any access to anything off of the Indian reservations is if you participate in this elected system. So it took them a couple of decades to create it. And since they created it, our people have been fighting each other. You know, the families have been frustrated with the amount of stuff that we can survive off of. And, you know, these Indian reservations continue to exist. It's a huge black eye in the world, you know, to have people who have never surrendered their lands being forced onto reservations and continuing to live in these reservations in often very atrocious ways. You know, you go on to a lot of our First Nations communities and you visit the communities and go into some of the households, you'll see what I mean. It's, you know, less than third world conditions.
In this context, what are the relations between the band councils and the companies or the corporations who want to build those pipelines?
The government has been very clear in their position. They've said that the only form of government that they recognize are the elected forms of government, which means that they only recognize the dysfunctional forms of government that they created on our Indian reservations, the elected system. Democracy has failed us for a very long time. And it continues to fail us. Even within our communities, it's failing us. You know, the democracy in the larger scheme of things, like the provincial governments and the federal governments, continues to fail us as well. You know, every time a new leadership is elected in, the new party, they're in charge of all the resources. They're in charge of continuing to steal resources from Aboriginal people. And so that's not doing us any favors.
It's kind of like the role that the government gives to the band council is to arrange with them to continue the colonization process.
Exactly. The band councils, you know, they're happy because we've been impoverished. Like the Canadian government put us in poverty when they put us onto reservations. They've kept us in poverty. They've taken our children away in Indian residential schools. They took them away for adoption in the 60s scoops. And, you know, they've kept us in very, very dire living conditions for all these years, and now they're empowering the people who are elected under their system, their model of government, to make decisions with companies and with government on proposed projects. And industry and government are happy to do that because they don't want to acknowledge the hereditary people who fought in the Supreme Court of Canada. They're only interested in acknowledging people who they put in place. The puppets. We call them government chiefs.
Yeah, because they are made by the government in some ways. In the point of view of the environment, the lands, how you perceive the difference between the relation you have as traditional forms of government with the lands and the way that the band council are dealing with lands?
Well, band councils, really, they're the only jurisdiction band councils have are on the Indian reservations that were created by the Indian Act. And their jurisdiction stops there. But they've been allowed to participate in the treaty process here in BC with the provincial government and the Canadian government. And in that treaty process, they're allowed to begin claiming areas that weren't theirs. So it was a ploy by the government of Canada and the provincial governments to enable an organization or a government system that they created, a dysfunctional one and a desperate one, to employ them to begin making claims on lands that weren't really theirs. The hereditary governments have been fighting for this for a while, and the Gitxsan and Wet'suwet'en people have led the charge and have won back in 1997 to no avail. Today, the government and industry continue to ignore us.
It's why also the people like the Gitxsan Nation block the office of the band council recently because the Elmer Derrick, that's the name of the guy, who signed the agreement with Enbridge.
Yeah. Well, that's another scenario that our people are dealing with. You know, one of the things, big complaints that a lot of our, I come from a grassroots group of people. One of the big complaints that we have about things that are interfering with our form of government, the same government that my grandfather, Madik, had back when I was a child, and I witnessed him dealing with other chiefs and making decisions on his territories. That same government that he looked after is being interfered with now by another group of leaders that a lot of us grassroots people are calling and traditional people are calling society chiefs. You know, these society chiefs are the ones that work under the Societies Act. They have Robert's Rules of Order that they follow. and they make decisions on a board of directors, and that board of directors can make decisions without even consulting with the membership. So it's a messed up system that the Canadian government kind of makes available for us to try and look legitimate. And when the real legitimate owners of the land try and assert ourselves, you know, it's very difficult because they say, oh, we don't recognize you guys because you aren't a society, or you're not a band council, or you're not one of the ones that we've created, you know, in order for you to look and behave dysfunctionally. If you want to be healthy and you want to be hereditary systems, then we're not going to recognize you guys. You need to fall into one of these pigeonholes.
What is the role of an hereditary chief like you, traditionally? For the people who don't know, yeah, what is your role?
Well, a lot of us are groomed since childhood. Like, for example, I was groomed from my grandparents, Medik and Saatne, from my father's side, to understand the land, the territories, the hunting, the trapping, fishing, going up in the mountains, berry picking, going out and collecting medicines, preparing all of these things at home. So I got a very, very solid understanding of that. But they've always taught me to understand that there's a balance. If you take that balance away, or if you participate in that balance, then you will suffer in the future. So that's something I've always been taught from my father's grandparents. My mother's grandparents, on the other hand, they taught me about the feast system. There's something that we call the potlatch. It's a large feast that our people have. And whenever there's something that happens in a community, or if somebody takes a name, if say somebody passes away, you have a funeral feast for them, or that person may have had a very, very large hereditary name, and it's time for somebody else to take that name, we'll have another name-giving feast. We'll have totem pole raising feasts, those types of things. And it's the type of business that we have that teaches us and it teaches the rest of the world about who we are and why we are there taking that responsibility. Now, when we're taught that role in our feast system, we're also taught to understand that's very, very, very connected to the territories that belong to our people. Like, I come from the Fireweed clan, the Laksamisu, and we have traditional territories out in the land. So whenever we have a feast, one of the things that we're expected to do is go out and hunt and fish and trap on our territory and bring the things from our territory into the feast. And we would talk about our feasts. The blankets that we wear on our backs represent the territory that we belong to. There's a very intimate connection between the business that we take care of and the decisions that we make on the land to the business that happens between us and our neighbors.
It's also that you belong to the land, and not the land is you're not your own property.
No, we are property of the land, absolutely, no.
And that's very important, particularly in the context, to remember.
Yes.
Can you tell more about that?
About the connection that we have with the land?
Yeah, and the fact that you belong to the earth and not the earth to you.
There's something that a lot of our people believe in. I remember hearing elders talk about this when I was a child. They would often talk about how the territory, when you assume a traditional name in a feast hall, with that name, you have a territory. So that elder has that chief has to go out on their land, and have to spend a lot of time on their traditional territory. They have to understand everything about it, where the trails are, if there are caves, if there are places where you can collect medicines, where can you hunt for the best for these types of animals in the valleys, where can you hunt the best for these types of animals in the mountains, and where can you fish for different types of fish, like lake fish or river fish, salmon. You know, you get a very, very intimate experience with the land. And during your lifetime, a lot of our elders said that we're so connected to the land that we can feel it on our bodies. So if something's happening on the land, often the elders will say, oh, there's something happening up in the mountain right now. There's something very terrible that just happened. I have to go and see what happened, because they felt something on their body. So there's a physical connection that they have with the land. So they'll actually stop what they're doing, pack up their stuff, head back out into the territory to investigate to see what had happened out there.